KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
Good morning. President Trump says the United States has a trade deal with the UK. What does the agreement with a longtime ally mean for the president's trade war? What we know so far in this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News.
Years ago today, the U.S. and its allies celebrated victory in Europe at the end of World War II. I'm Leila Faldick.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. How are Europeans recalling that moment and reflecting on the way the world has changed? Also, why is Hollywood struggling? And why are Boise and Salt Lake City defying state laws on which flags they can fly? It is Thursday, May 8th, World Red Cross and Red Crescent Day. That's an idea for a day of action which came about after World War I to advance the cause of peace. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Trump says he's reached a new trade deal with the United Kingdom. It's the first major trade deal reached since Trump imposed his global tariffs.
With this deal, the UK joins the United States in affirming that reciprocity and fairness is an essential and vital principle of international trade. The deal includes billions of dollars of increased market access for American exports, especially in agriculture, dramatically increasing access for American beef, ethanol, and virtually all of the products produced by our great farmers.
The president's press conference is still underway at the White House. Roman Catholic cardinals are again gathered in the Vatican's Sistine Chapel. They're choosing the next pope. They did not select a pope in the first round of voting yesterday, and they sent up black smoke through the chapel's chimney to signal the results of their vote. They held another round of voting this morning, and again, they sent up black smoke, noting that no pope has been selected. NPR's Sarah Ventry is in St. Peter's Square.
We are now in the afternoon of the second day of the conclave, where 133 cardinal electors will decide who among them is the next pope. In the meantime, there are thousands of people milling around St. Peter's Square, all anxiously awaiting smoke. And there is just kind of a mood of excitement and a little bit of electricity in the crowd. Whether people are religious or not, whether they're Catholic or not, everyone I've spoken to is excited to be here for this historical moment.
NPR's Sarah Ventry at the Vatican. A new documentary identifies the Israeli soldier who allegedly killed a Palestinian-American journalist in 2022. Her killing in the Israeli-occupied West Bank sparked international condemnation and a U.S. inquiry. NPR's Daniel Estrin has more from Tel Aviv.
The film Who Killed Shireen, which debuted in New York, presents new claims in the killing of Al Jazeera journalist Shireen Abu Akleh. A 20-year-old soldier is named in the film as being responsible for her killing in the Jenin refugee camp. The soldier was killed in the same area during a military raid last year. The Israeli military says there is no definitive determination of who killed the journalist. A U.S. government review after her death determined an Israeli soldier unintentionally killed her. A former U.S. official in the film who spoke to NPR anonymously to discuss internal government deliberations says the initial U.S. assessment was that her killing was intentional and that those findings were changed. Daniel Estrin, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Fresh violence is being reported between Pakistan and India today. Pakistani officials claim they shot down more than two dozen Indian drones today that flew over major Pakistani cities. This comes after India fired missiles into Pakistan this week in retaliation for the killings of 26 civilians. This is NPR. The UN says relief operations in Sudan are in serious jeopardy. The rebel Rapid Support Forces have attacked the eastern city of Port Sudan for days. It's sheltering about a quarter of a million refugees. The UN cannot fly planes filled with aid into Port Sudan. 80 years ago today, in 1945, the Allies announced they had accepted Nazi Germany's unconditional surrender. This ended World War II in Europe. It became known as Victory in Europe, or VE Day. NPR's Lauren Freyer reports from London. There are memorials and moments of silence today across Europe.
It's been eight decades to the day since British Prime Minister Winston Churchill went on the radio to announce the
unconditional surrender of all German land, sea, and air forces in Europe.
Across Britain, there are tea parties in the street for VE Day's 80th anniversary, and pubs are staying open 2 hours later in celebration of the greatest generation. In France, there's a wreath-laying ceremony in front of a statue of wartime General Charles de Gaulle. But there are also fears for Europe's future security amid the war in Ukraine and fraying relations with the United States. Lauren Freyer, NPR News, London.
Transportation Secretary Sean Duffy is scheduled to hold a news conference later today. He is expected to announce plans to address problems in the nation's air traffic control system. This comes after an air traffic outage was reported last week at Newark's airport in New Jersey. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. This is NPR.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. Good morning. Here is the latest we have on the prospect of a trade deal between the United States and the United Kingdom. President Trump promised to announce a trade agreement this morning. He's under a lot of pressure to do that and help to ease the trade war that he launched on the world. The announcement is now underway at the White House, and it seems to be something well short of a final agreement. NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben is on the line to describe what we do know. She's at the White House. Hey there, Danielle.
Morning, Steve.
What are you hearing?
Well, this is very, very new, as you said. President Trump and UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer just spoke to American press. Trump and his officials are still talking to the US press. Prime Minister Starmer is doing a press conference in the UK right now about this. So this is ongoing.
Okay.
But from what we have so far, what they said at the top, we still don't have many details on what the two countries have agreed to because the deal isn't fully finished yet. Here's what Trump said.
The final details are being written up in the coming weeks. We'll have it all very conclusive, but the actual deal is a very conclusive one. We think just about everything's been approved.
Now, Trump did add that the deal will allow more American agricultural products, like beef and ethanol, to be sold in the UK. He also added that machinery and chemicals could get greater market access there. Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick also said that the 10% tariff on UK goods that Trump imposed earlier is still on. That's interesting. So as we get more details, a big question is what the UK is going to get out of all of this. The White House didn't give much info on that. And we're going to hear more as Starmer says more and as the two countries say more. But one other thing they added, Lutnick mentioned that automobiles were a part of this deal, and machinery and cars are the number one export from the UK to the US. And that matters because Trump imposed a 25% tariff on autos and auto parts. So it's possible that that could be a part of this deal.
Okay, so we have we have an announcement today, and I'm just being literal in what we're being told by the president. He is weeks away from an announcement that he is announcing today. The details
right.
are not there. We have concepts of a plan. A phrase the president used in a different context. But we do not have a final, we don't have the final details, and the details, of course, are everything here. Nevertheless, right. There appears to be some measure of agreement. We expect to hear from the UK Prime Minister, you mentioned. We're hearing from the UK Prime Minister as well. So something has been agreed on some level. How big a deal is this?
Well, it will be a big deal once we know what's in this deal, because this will have been the first deal that Trump has negotiated since he imposed a wave of tariffs on global goods and on goods from all sorts of countries. It's not a big deal in the sense of this one deal with the UK is not going to immediately or substantively ease up recession and shortage fears that so many Americans have right now. Because a reminder of how we got here, Trump went on this tear of imposing tariffs on steel and aluminum, on auto parts, and then there was what he called Liberation Day, where he imposed tariffs on nearly all countries' goods. And some of those tariffs were very high. After markets and consumers and businesses got spooked, Trump paused those tariffs for 90 days and instead imposed that 10% blanket tariff on all countries, including the UK. During that pause, he said his country would negotiate tariffs down country by country. So that brings us to today. This is the first of those deals. The White House says many more deals are in process, but they've been very tight-lipped about what those might be. The one thing I would add here is that the elephant in the room on all of this is China, which is an even bigger trading partner with the U.S. than the U.K. is.
Sure.
Trump has 145% tariffs on Chinese goods. China has high tariffs. So the big question is, what happens to those?
Okay. NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben with the latest we know about the prospect of a trade deal with the U.K. Danielle, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Blasts heard over Pakistan's second-largest city signal the most recent salvo in a generations-long conflict in South Asia.
This morning, residents in Pakistan's second-largest city of Lahore were hearing explosions. Pakistan's military spokesman, Lieutenant General Ahmad Sharif, says Pakistan shot down Indian drones, which he says were flying over major cities.
This naked aggression continues, and the armed forces are on high degree of alert and neutralizing them as we speak. This is a serious, serious provocation.
This comes after India launched multiple strikes across Pakistan on Wednesday. These were the most extensive attacks that India has carried out in more than 50 years. India says it was responding to terror attacks last month launched out of Pakistani territory.
On the line with us is NPR's Dia Hadid. She's in Mumbai and covers both India and Pakistan. Good morning.
Good morning, Laila.
So do you just bring us up to speed? What is happening today?
Right. Well, the Pakistani Army spokesman, Lieutenant General Ahmad Sharif, accused India of sending across 25 Israeli-made drones this morning. He says some of them flew over major population centres, including Karachi, which is the biggest city in the country with 20 million people, and crucially, Rawalpindi, which is home to Pakistan's general military headquarters. Sharif says they shot down all the drones, except for one that targeted an old airport in Lahore. He says four military personnel were injured and one civilian killed. Sharif just spoke to the media in English. That's a signal that his message is for the West.
It appears that India has apparently lost the plot. And rather than going on a path of rationality, is further escalating in a highly charged environment to satisfy the hubristic mindset of the Indian government.
What he's referring to there, Leila, is India's Hindu nationalist government, which had vowed retribution for a militant attack in late April, where gunmen opened fire on tourists in a meadow, killing 26. India blamed Pakistan for that attack. Pakistan says it's not connected, but it's that incident which triggered these escalations.
Right, but I'm thinking, where does this go? It seems like tensions are just rising and rising at this point.
At this point, yes, but if I can step back a bit, when India struck Pakistan earlier this week, the Indian military had quickly signaled they were not seeking an escalation. And Pakistan said it shot down five Indian military aircraft. And analysts told me they were waiting to see if that would be enough for Pakistan to show its people that the army was defending the country. Even this morning, the Pakistani Deputy Prime Minister confirmed that national security advisers of both countries had spoken to each other, so it was looking hopeful. But then the accusation happened of India sending drones over Pakistani airspace. So Ajay Shukla, he is a retired Indian Army colonel, and he says any new development here changes all calculations.
And the dynamic between those two are sort of hostile and sort of aggressive. then what was said 2 days ago no longer holds good. There is absolutely a scope for something bigger.
Has India said anything about these allegations about the drones?
Not so far, but India's foreign minister has just said if the country is attacked, there'll be a firm response. And it's important to remember already in this latest escalation, there are casualties, more than 30 people on the Pakistani side, including children, and more than 12 people killed in India. And that doesn't even include the 26 people who were killed by gunmen in late April, which triggered this whole escalation.
That's Dia Hadid in Mumbai. Thank you, Dia.
Thank you, Leila.
The world is watching the Vatican this morning as 133 cardinals work to choose which of them will be the next pope. Black smoke rose again earlier today from the chimney of the Sistine Chapel, indicating no pope has been chosen yet. NPR's Ruth Sherlock takes us to St. Peter's Square.
It's extremely unlikely that there will be white smoke this early on, but nonetheless, St. Peter's Square is full of people. One thing you notice, this is a very religious crowd. It's priests, nuns, monks.
I came to evoke the Holy Spirit.
Vicente Goes is a Jesuit student of philosophy in Rome, and he says people haven't come because they think a pope will be elected so quickly.
The majority of the people, there's a feeling of the need to pray, because this is a time where we are with this sensation of vertigo. We are in the hands of God.
Everybody's got excited, they've got their phones out. The big screens here in St. Peter's Square have zeroed in on the chimney. There's a seagull on the chimney with a prime view.
The most famous seagull in the world right now.
Lisa Malfatti has come all the way from California for the conclave.
It's meaningful for the world because we are at a turning point with Catholicism.
With many people in the West turning away from the faith, as we speak, the hours pass, way past the time the results of this first vote were expected. People sing.
Every time the seagull comes back, the crowd claps and laughs. And now they're clapping also to try to send a message. Please send this smoke. Even the priests are starting to look tired.
Until eventually...
There you have it. It's hard to tell in the darkness, but it is black smoke. Today is not the day the Catholic Church gets its new pope.
Ruth Sherlock, NPR News, St. Peter's Square, the Vatican.
We are also following the effort to select a new pope, which is taking place at Vatican City inside the Sistine Chapel. Many people outside the chapel have been watching that chimney for the color of smoke. 133 cardinals are voting on their next leader. A two-thirds majority is required. Some ballots have already passed without a decision, and we have no information from inside, which of course is traditional. We'll continue to bring you more as we learn it. And while the world waits to see who will replace the late Pope Francis, many thousands of the faithful have gathered in and around St. Peter's Square. This is NPR News.
Thank you. On the next Fresh Air, journalist Amanda Hess explores how technology now shapes every aspect of parenting, from online identities to the pressure of sharing our lives in real time. She's written a new book about it called Second Life, Having a Child in the Digital Age. Join us.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from Proven Winners, with Proven Winners Color Choice Shrubs, offering flowering shrubs and evergreens selected for home landscapes. More at provenwinnerscolorchoice.com/NPR. From the Kauffman Foundation, providing access to opportunities that help people achieve financial stability, upward mobility, and economic prosperity, regardless of race, gender, or geography. Kauffman.org. From Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Jury selection in the trial of music mogul Sean Combs, also known as P. Diddy, began this week. He's pleaded not guilty to charges of sex trafficking, racketeering, conspiracy. Prosecutors allege that Combs' famous parties often devolved into group sex parties where some guests were coerced into taking drugs and sexually assaulted. But while the accusations against Combs are particularly sensational and disturbing, his arrest last year has sparked a lot of discussion about whether the alleged behavior is actually that unusual in the industry. Ty Stichlorius has been part of that conversation. She's one of the top female executives in music. John Legend, for example, is one of the people she works with, and she's written about what she says needs to change, and she's with us now to tell us more about that. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle. I'm happy to be here.
You actually wrote about your experience at a party thrown by Combs when you were just out of college. Now, I know this was a long time ago, and I know it's not easy to talk about, but would you just briefly say what happened?
Yes, I was in my early 20s, and I went to a party thrown by Sean Combs. It was on a very large yacht. I had heard that there was a dance party down somewhere in the yacht, and this man who was a colleague of Sean's told me that he could take me there, and he led me into a bedroom and then locked the door behind me. And I just remember being terrified, but I want to be clear, that wasn't just one bad night. That was the culture.
First of all, I just want to let people know, as you report in your piece, and it was as a guest essay in the New York Times, you were able to talk your way out of that situation. Yeah. So very glad of that. But you also wrote, you do now know, after 20 years as a music industry executive, that what happened that night was no aberration. It was an indicator of a pervasive culture in the music industry that actively fostered sexual misconduct and exploited the lives and bodies of those hoping to make it in the business. It's a pretty damning thing to say that this isn't actually an isolated thing.
Well, I mean, if you think about the tagline for music for a long time, it's been sex, drugs, and rock and roll. This is a story and a case about how power has operated in the music industry. And I think we need to be careful not to isolate this to one man or one case, because those of us who've worked in the business, sadly, don't find this all that surprising. It's about a system that for decades allowed certain men to operate with total impunity.
Why does this persist? I mean, is it because, in part, so much business is done in non-traditional places, like, you know, meetings and hotel rooms and places like that? You know what I mean? Why? A lot of people who don't work in these fields just think, what's going on here?
Well, you're right. To talk about the casting couch in the music business, that's the recording studio. Unfortunately, I think many of the people who controlled who was in those spaces used it as a way to exploit. I mean, when I was first trying to get a job in the music business, every interview, which ended up being some kind of dinner, was a key card in my hand at the end of the night. Like,
wait, hold on. What do you mean a key card? You mean somebody putting their hotel card in?
Oh, yeah.
Basically implying you're supposed to go and have sex with them.
Exactly. And after that happened three separate times, I actually gave up on the music business. I thought, this isn't where I want to be.
As I mentioned that we started with talking about the essay that you wrote for the New York Times back in October when Sean Combs was first arrested, you got a lot of comments. And a number of women wrote and said they gave up on the music industry because they just could not take all of the harassment. I was curious how you felt when you saw that.
Yes, I was surprised how many women who are actually still in the music business reached out to me and said, I've never told my story. I'm afraid if I do, I'll be fired. And these are women in positions of power. I think part of it is we have to talk about NDAs.
Non-disclosure agreements.
Yes. I think they play a huge role. I know many men and women who've been threatened with the end of their careers if they spoke up. NDAs have been signed and they're signing away their truth in exchange for basic rights like song ownership or fair pay. That silence wasn't consent. It was survival.
Do you think that record labels are really willing to let somebody go who's talented because they're abusive?
I unfortunately have not seen proof of that. You know, I've reported abuses and it's a very polite thank you. And then they hung up the phone and I see very few consequences come from it. You look at how long it took R. Kelly and P. Diddy to be held accountable. That's the part that bothers me, is that people have not stood up for something better. And I think we need to change that.
Ty Stiklourios is the CEO and founder of Friends at Work. That's a management firm, and she's one of the highest ranking women in the music industry. Thanks so much for talking with us. Very sobering.
Thank you, Michelle.
The city council in Boise, Idaho made a decision. Leaders of Salt Lake City, Utah made that decision too. Both cities will continue flying pride flags. Both are working around state laws that limit what kinds of banners can be flown on city properties. Here's Julie Lucata of Boise State Public Radio.
In February, Idaho's legislature passed a law prohibiting non-official flags from being flown on government property. But this week, Boise's city council passed a resolution making the pride flag an official city flag, allowing it to be flown at city buildings. About 100 people, mostly supporters, rallied in front of City Hall before the vote. Boise City Council member Meredith Stead said the city had flown the pride flag for a decade, and removing it would not be a neutral gesture.
It would signal a retreat from values we've long upheld and send a disheartening message to those who have found affirmation and belonging through its presence at City Hall.
Melody Osman protested the vote outside, saying the pride flag was divisive and did not represent the majority of residents.
It's about government spaces trying to remain neutral and supporting and being a voice for everyone, not just a select few.
In April, Idaho's Republican Attorney General sent Boise's mayor a letter urging her to comply with the state's ban on unofficial flags. He said the city could be denied state funds if she didn't. As currently written, the law does not have specific penalties for breaking it. On the same day, Salt Lake City's council okayed flying the Pride, transgender, and Juneteenth flags at city buildings. They added a city symbol, the sago lily, to each of the banners. That, the council believes, will allow them to comply with a state law similar to Idaho's ban on unofficial flags. For NPR News, I'm Julie Lucata in Boise.
This is NPR News.
World War II ended in Europe 80 years ago today. That anniversary resonates with NPR's Bob Mondello, who recently found some long-forgotten letters his mother saved from her time working with the Red Cross.
Guy. I met him at the Corso Club, June 17, 1945. He plays ping pong, but I beat him.
Bob Mondello remembers his mother. On the next All Things Considered from NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. President Trump's announced the framework of a new trade deal between the United States and the United Kingdom.
The final details are being written up in the coming weeks. We'll have it all very conclusive, but the actual deal is a very conclusive one. We think just about everything's been approved. So good for both countries, and we'll also receive new market access for American chemicals, machinery, and many other industrial products that weren't allowed.
Earlier today, Britain's central bank cut interest rates, but there was division over the quarter percentage point cut. Two policymakers wanted an even bigger reduction. Two others voted to keep rates unchanged. While monitoring the tariffs' impact on the U.S. economy, the Federal Reserve says it's keeping the key rate as is for now. President Trump's been pressuring the Fed to reduce it. Tensions continue to escalate between nuclear-armed neighbors India and Pakistan. NPR's Dee Hadid reports on explosions heard in Lahore, Pakistan today.
The Pakistani Army spokesman, Lieutenant General Ahmed Sharif, accused India of sending across 25 Israeli-made drones this morning. He says some of them flew over major population centers, including Karachi, which is the biggest city in the country with 20 million people, and crucially, Rawalpindi, which is home to Pakistan's general military headquarters. Sharif says they shot down all the drones, except for one that targeted an old airport in Lahore.
And PRC Hadid, this is NPR. On this first full day of the conclave to find the late Pope Francis's successor, cardinals held two votes, but they again fell short of a two-thirds majority, evident in the black smoke that again billowed from the Sistine Chapel's chimney. And so crowds of people wait in St. Peter's Square. Isabel Lammers traveled from Chicago for this moment.
We're just so divided as a world, so it would be nice to just hug someone with a lot of love.
133 cardinals are taking part in the papal conclave. On Capitol Hill, a top Democrat in the House says it's time for his party to embrace a ban on stock trading by members of Congress. For Member Station KQED, Scott Schaefer has details.
California Congressman Pete Aguilar says when members of Congress make money off stock trades based on information they're privy to, it raises legitimate questions and concerns. And Aguilar, who chairs the House Democratic Caucus, notes it happens fairly regularly.
I know the country is cynical of politicians, but those types of things just are absolutely detrimental to having trust in government. It really just sends a terrible message.
Several bills to reform stock trades have been introduced in recent years but never passed. There are several bipartisan reform bills this year. Aguilar isn't endorsing any particular approach but says it's time for Democrats to support change. For NPR News, I'm Scott Schaefer in Washington.
The Dow is up nearly 400 points. It's NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Uma, a cloud-based phone service for any size business, with an automated virtual receptionist, video meetings, and other features to connect to customers and coworkers anywhere at uma.com/NPR. From Indeed, committed to giving job listings increased visibility with relevant candidates through its sponsored jobs feature. Learn more at indeed.com/NPR. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Steve Inskeep. 80 years ago today, in 1945, British Prime Minister Winston Churchill made an announcement. Nazi Germany had surrendered.
Hostilities will end officially at 1 minute after midnight tonight.
This was known as Victory in Europe Day, or VE Day. It marked the end of World War II in Europe, although Japan in the Pacific would not surrender for some months more. Today, there are memorials and moments of silence across Europe, as well as fears for Europe's security, which has depended ever since on arrangements made at the end of that war. NPR's Lauren Frayer is in London. Hey there, Lauren.
Hi, Steve.
What's the scene in Europe?
So the day began in London with a memorial service at Westminster Abbey. There's a nationwide moment of silence and tea parties this afternoon. Hmm. Pubs are open 2 hours late tonight so that you can raise a glass to what Americans call the greatest generation. It's been a week of VE Day events here. They began Monday with a military parade, and here's what it sounded like. King Charles stood at attention saluting troops and cavalry in those furry black hats and red coats. Royals and politicians were seated on a parade stand mixed in with World War II veterans, many of them with walking sticks and wheelchairs.
I think all holidays should have a tea party and pubs open 2 hours
totally.
Late. And it's a reminder, this is a celebration of a happy moment, although also a somber moment because so many millions of people were killed in the war, but it ended on this day. What kinds of scenes are there across Europe?
There's a wreath-laying ceremony in Paris tonight, but as you say, it's a more somber day, especially in Germany. I asked a German historian, Katja Hoyer. She says May 8th is celebrated there as a day of liberation.
The German people were liberated by the Allies from their own regime, from Nazism. But this concept also exonerates ordinary Germans to a degree, because the concept of liberation implies that they were held captive by their own Nazi regime and then were liberated by it rather than having supported it in the first place.
She says Germans are still struggling with the idea of taking responsibility for, because, you know, many of them supported the Nazis during those years.
Okay, so how do new threats to Europe's security factor into these commemorations today?
Ukrainian soldiers actually marched in that military parade I played you the sound of there, and King Charles saluted them as well as the British troops. There is a sense across Europe that the post-World War II order is crumbling. I spoke to a historian at Oxford University, Timothy Garton Ash, and he says there are three big threats to Europe today.
The war in Ukraine is by far the largest war in Europe since 1945. Countries like China and India and Turkey, and we're in a post-Western world, if you like. And then with President Donald Trump, we Europeans feel we can no longer rely on the US security umbrella on which we've relied for most of this 80 years.
So he says this is a really critical moment. And he says, you know, just 5 years ago, the 75th anniversaries of VE Day were really like a celebration. And even though they were under COVID lockdown then, now just 5 years later, the 80th anniversary is really tinged with fear, threats, and a feeling of abandonment from the United States.
What's the scene in Russia, which was also on the winning side 80 years ago?
In Russia, it's called Victory Day, and it's celebrated tomorrow, because when Churchill said at midnight, that was actually the next day in Russia's time zones. So there will be a big parade in Red Square tomorrow. Russia says dozens of world leaders are attending, including China's Xi Jinping and Brazil's Lula da Silva.
And NPR's Lauren Frayer, thanks.
You're welcome.
The Trump administration wants to send migrants to Libya, possibly as soon as this week.
Libya. U.S. officials have spent the last few months negotiating with various countries to see who is willing to take in people deported from the United States.
NPR's immigration reporter Ximena Osteo joins us now to talk about all this. Good morning, Ximena.
Good morning.
So what do we know about this plan to send migrants to Libya?
Yesterday, my colleague Tom Bowman confirmed administration officials are planning to use Libya as a destination for migrants removed from the U.S. Rwanda's foreign minister also said it was in talks with Washington about the same issue. And of course, the U.S. has had similar deals already with Mexico and El Salvador. Now, the deportations to Libya would be carried out by the U.S. military, but it's not clear how many people or what nationalities would be sent under the deal. President Trump told reporters yesterday he didn't know about the plan and to ask the Department of Homeland Security. Homeland Security did not respond to NPR's requests to confirm the plans.
Okay, so we've already seen actions in court to try and stop these military flights before they've even happened. What can you tell us about the lawsuit?
A judge in Massachusetts already issued an injunction blocking the Homeland Security Department from removing migrants to these third countries. That means deporting people to countries they're not originally from. The administration has found workarounds, though. They've used other agencies, such as the Defense Department, to remove people from the U.S. Immigration lawyers filed an emergency motion yesterday asking that same judge to again block removals to Libya or any third country. They argued their clients, who are Laotian, Vietnamese, and Filipino could be sent in a matter of hours. And last night, the judge issued another order. It clarifies DHS can't use a loophole and that any agencies, including the Pentagon, can't deport people to these third countries unless those people get prior time to contest their removals.
Okay, so there's a legal block in this court. I mean, Libya is not considered the safest country. Have other concerns been raised about this plan?
Mm-hmm. First off, Libya has been wrestling with violence and armed conflict since the civil war that toppled Muammar Gaddafi almost 15 years ago. The country is still in turmoil. There's a military strongman who controls the eastern half of the country, and a UN-backed government controls the west. And I'd note both governments issued statements rejecting the plan to send migrants there. And Libya has a notorious human rights record.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't the first deal, though, that the White House has made with other countries. We've already reported a lot on the U.S. paying El Salvador $6 million to house migrants removed from the U.S. in a mega prison there. What's the point of these agreements?
One of the main goals is to send migrants further away to avoid people crossing back over U.S. borders. And that's according to Secretary of State Marco Rubio. Mm. But there are plenty of practical implications. About 1.4 million people have pending deportation orders. That's according to the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Agency. But there are many challenges to sending them back to their home countries. One is that their home countries may not agree to accept them or actually have limits on how many people or flights they will take from the United States. And this has created challenges for past administrations because it means that even if someone has a final removal order, they may not actually be removed. But Trump's goal is to increase the pace of deportations, and that does mean finding more places for people to go. If Libya isn't under the table, others likely will be.
NPR's Ximena Bustillo. Thank you, Ximena.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
Tennis writer Christopher Clary's new book tells the story of Spanish superstar Rafael Nadal, his humble origins, his record-breaking success. Next time, here and now.
Your city, your station, your news. Download the NPR app today, your new home for live radio, local podcasts, and everything you love from NPR.
Good morning, I'm Steve Inskeep. Pro Hockey's Utah Hockey Club finally has a new name. Team ownership took more than a year and went through four rounds of community voting to come up with this name, sort of like picking a pope. And the new name is the Utah Mammoth. Mammoth, singular. Takes its inspiration from the mammoths who lived and roamed across what is now Utah. So Mammoth makes total sense. Sadly, the Lakers were already taken. It's Morning Edition.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Eric and Wendy Schmidt through the Schmidt Family Foundation, working toward a healthy, resilient, secure world for all. On the web at theschmidt.org. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. 2 years after writers and actors went on strike, Hollywood is still struggling to recover the resulting job losses in film and television production. Add to that the most expensive wildfires in California's history and a shrinking industry, and you got not as much show or biz happening in Hollywood. While President Trump says he wants to turn it all around with 100% tariffs on all films produced outside the U.S., many writers and producers are leaving the business altogether to a so-called creator economy, a growing field where people are producing digital content on their own terms and opting out of traditional Hollywood. That includes Amy Suto, an author and content creator. She told me about how she got her start in a talent agency as a starry-eyed graduate of USC's film school, which has churned out top Hollywood talent.
From there, I started moving up the ladder and going from assistant to writer assistant to showrunner assistant, and then eventually getting my own episode of TV. And when I was making that jump up the ladder, sometimes I was able to do really exciting things, but oftentimes you're answering phones, you're, you know, going on coffee runs for your boss. And there was a lot more politics than I had anticipated, with a lot more kind of power dynamics between the different hierarchies.
But isn't that just a part of Hollywood? I mean, isn't that just a part of how it is?
You'd think that, but I think the real issue is that as I was continuing on my career in Hollywood, there was becoming this shift as there was becoming fewer and fewer TV shows produced. There was becoming more and more kind of like short order streaming. The writers' rooms were going from 24 episodes to 6 episodes. But because there aren't these longer episodes, there's a lot less ability for writers to grow on these shows. And there's a lot less ability to kind of foster that kind of dynamic magic that happened in writers' rooms more in the early golden age of television, which had its flaws as well, but had more opportunity.
Did you ever feel like your creativity was being squashed?
Yeah, it's part of the reason why I started in between shows doing freelance memoir ghostwriting and writing my own books, because I started to realize that the projects that I was most creatively enlivened by were happening outside of Hollywood and outside of the industry. And my writing was being more valued by people outside of the industry than the people in it. And I just saw that there wasn't a creative future for people who wanted to not write the next Marvel film.
Are you able to stay afloat with what you're doing?
Yes, but in order to make writing your job, you actually do need to have a few different income streams. You know, writing on Substack is something a lot of people are doing. And self-publishing books is something that allows you to kind of bypass gatekeepers and be able to create books and put them out there on your own way. Since I left Hollywood, I've made way more than I've made any time that I was in the industry.
Recently, President Trump announced 100% tariffs on all films produced outside the U.S. Do you think that this kind of a move would help Hollywood, would help the industry?
I don't think so, because when it comes to the production side of things, Hollywood's always had different places it's gone to reduce costs and to be able to, you know, do on-location shoots in different countries. Like, I do think that that is an important part of Hollywood, to be able to have production happen elsewhere. If Hollywood really wants to shift and change, it needs to look inwards about how it treats its creatives and also how it structures its business with gatekeepers and making things for audiences that aren't just another big, you know, superhero franchise. And so taking risks on smaller creative projects and more of like the mid-level films that we used to see a lot of, kind of like undoing a little bit of what streaming broke, will also help the industry. But thinking about what is the way forward with different technologies and how to make things on a budget, but are more respecting of the artists that are coming in for the creative process, that are bringing their humanity to these stories that need to be told.
That's writer and content creator Amy Suto. Amy, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
This is NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Leila Fadel. 3 years ago, almost to the day, a renowned Palestinian-American journalist, Shireen Abu Akleh, was shot and killed as she covered an Israeli raid in the Palestinian city of Jenin in the occupied West Bank. She was a reporter for Al Jazeera, and she wore a clearly marked blue flak jacket with the word press when she was killed. At the time, President Biden vowed to get to the bottom of her killing.
The United States will continue to insist on a full and transparent accounting of her death and will continue to stand up for media freedom everywhere in the world.
Today, no one has been held accountable. A review by the U.S. government determined it was likely an Israeli soldier who killed Abu Akleh. It also concluded it was a tragic mistake. But a group of journalists reveal in a new documentary called Who Killed Shireen that the initial findings of that inquiry told a very different story. That documentary from the media company Zateo is out now. I spoke with Dion Nissenbaum, one of the journalists involved and an executive producer of the film.
We were able to find a key U.S. official to talk to us who told us that U.S. personnel went to the scene in the West Bank city of Jenin where Shireen was killed to try and figure out what happened. And their initial assessment was that the Israeli soldier intentionally targeted Shireen.
It was an indication that it was an intentional killing of, at this point in time, Shireen Abu Akleh. They would have absolutely known that it was a media person, or not combatant at a minimum, that that person shot and killed her.
In the film, as you can hear, the former U.S. official's voice is distorted. NPR's Daniel Estrin also spoke to that former U.S. official, who also requested anonymity from us to discuss sensitive internal government discussions. The official said the U.S. initially found that the killing was intentional, that the soldier would have known he was shooting at a journalist. But he said those findings were changed, and ultimately the U.S. concluded there was no reason to believe the shooting was intentional. Again, Dion Nissenbaum.
That initial assessment was essentially overruled by the Biden administration, and they came out and said explicitly that it was unintentional.
So what did you make of that when you heard that?
For me, one of the main reasons I wanted to do this documentary is that so many people just don't understand what happened to Shireen that day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Israeli investigation itself concluded that it was very likely that an Israeli soldier falsely identified Shireen as a militant and intentionally killed her. That really is not in debate. There were no militants near her that they were aiming for. She was not caught in any crossfire. The Israeli investigation itself concluded that the soldier intentionally shot her.
Did you find Shireen's killer?
We did find Shireen's killer. He was a 20-year-old soldier who was on his first combat deployment in the West Bank. And we were able to track him down. And he actually was himself killed in Jenin last summer. So he was killed in the city where he killed Shireen.
And how did you confirm that this was actually the person that fired the bullet? Did you reach out to the IDF, to his family?
We have reached out. We confirmed it with Israeli soldiers that knew him and served with him. And we have spoken with the Israeli military about this at length. The Israeli military is declining to comment on this. I can tell you with, you know, high confidence we have identified the shooter.
You know, there are, and you note this in your documentary too, that the Committee to Protect Journalists has documented upward of 176 journalists and media workers, and they determine and allege at least 17 of those journalists and two media workers were directly targeted by Israeli forces. CPJ's classifying them as murders. Why focus on this killing?
Well, her killing was in some ways, you know, the beginning of a trajectory for the Israeli military before Shireen, Israel was never on the list of most dangerous countries for journalists. And now, according to the Committee to Protect Journalists, Israel is considered the most dangerous country for journalists because of what's happening in Gaza. And two more Gaza journalists were killed in new strikes in Gaza. And so you just see a real shift in the way the Israeli military looks at journalists, and it's becoming ever more dangerous for journalists to work there.
And since her killing, six other Americans have been killed in Israeli fire.
That's right. As we note in the documentary, there are folks like Senator Chris Van Hollen who do believe that the Biden administration's failure to hold Israel to account and get them to change the way they operate did lead to the death of other Americans in the West Bank.
What do you hope this film will achieve?
I'm hoping that it will lead to some reflections from the Israeli military about the way that they operate in the West Bank around civilians and journalists. I'm hoping that the U.S. government will reflect on its own responsibility and trying to seek some justice for an American citizen who was killed by the Israeli military. I hope there's some reflection from U.S. officials about ways that they can stand up for Americans in that situation.
Diane Nissenbaum is one of the executive producers of the documentary Who Killed Shireen? It's out now on Zateo. Thank you so much, Diane.
Thank you, Leila.
The Israeli military told NPR it does not deliberately target journalists. It also says some of the journalists and media workers documented by the Committee to Protect Journalists were Hamas operatives and therefore lawful targets. We asked the Israeli military for a response to the findings in this documentary. They said in a statement, Zateo has decided to publish the name of the soldier who fell during an operational activity, despite the family's request not to publish the name. And even though they were told there is no definitive determination regarding the identity of the individual responsible for the shooting that caused the journalist's death. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Leila Faldin.